Hello, and welcome to the Inside Reviews podcast for October the 14th, 2022. This is episode number 132. On today's show, we'll be talking about the debut of the Polestar 3, General Motors jumping into the energy business, and the Renault Mobilize Duo has launched. I'm Dominic Gioni, Inside EVs forum moderator and Inside EVs editor. Joining us today is the sanguine Tom Malogny, Inside EVs editor and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge. We also have the multidisciplinary Mr. Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast, which is available on all the best podcast platforms. And of course, the convivial Kyle Connor joins us from the majestic, practically palatial halls of Out of Spec Studios, where he produces high voltage videos for a growing number of YouTube channels. Welcome, everybody.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. So let's kick this thing off with some news and then get to what we've been driving this week. So the big news of the week is the launch of the Polestar 3, the first SUV in the Polestar lineup and its second volume vehicle. The actual reveal video from Polestar was pretty cool with this. So basically, they had this huge white cube on a small rocky island. A wall slowly folds down and there's a car. The car is attached to the wall so that when it's fully down, the car looks like it's ready to go out on the open road. But there's no road in front of it. It's like the open sea. So it looked kind of spectacular. But the fancy debut aside, the Polestar 3 will be manufactured in Chengdu, China, starting mid-2023, and South Carolina starting mid-2024. U.S. orders will be filled by the China plant until the Ridgeville plant starts producing like a year later. So interestingly, the Polestar 3 is built on the Volvo SPA platform, like the Polestar 1, rather than the CMA platform under Polestar 2. It will come with all-wheel drive and loaded with most features. It's got like a 1,600-watt 25-speaker Bowers & Wilkins stereo in there, so it should be a pretty nice space to spend some time. There are only a few minor options, but a performance package is available, which gives you more power, less range, but a Polestar engineered performance chassis, 22-inch wheels, gold seat belts and valve stem caps for Kyle, and gold ambient lighting. Numbers-wise, it's a 400-volt system with a 111-kilowatt-hour battery, 107 kilowatt-hours usable. They say it can recharge from 10 to 80 in 30 minutes at a DC fast charge station capable of supplying 250 kilowatts of power. Range in the base version is expected to be 300 miles on the EPA test, while the performance pack gets 270 miles on a charge. 0 to 60 is given as 4.9 seconds in the base car, 4.6 in the spicy version. Kyle, deliveries start about a year from now, and the price is like the same in euros as is American dollars. It's kind of neat. So it's $83,900. Have you reserved one yet?
No, I don't need a three-row SUV at the moment, but
it's two.
Can we just talk about how cool this thing is? We're finally, sure. I like Polestar because they sit somewhere between mainstream everyday and full on luxury. I think the price tag is high, and that's, I think, the same for Polestar 2 and especially Polestar 1, fitting that they're a little bit up there where it's a kind of like a subtle status symbol to drive one. I think stunning looks, really nice looking car. Polestar's always been very good at that. I think the specs on the inside sound wonderful. Very interesting they're using SPA. SPA came out in 2016, launched on the XC90. Then we saw XC60. So basically, 60 and 90 chassis cars from Volvo have always been built on SPA, scalable product architecture. They fit a huge battery in this thing, 111 kilowatt hour gross, I think 107 usable. I know we did an Out of Spec podcast on this. I didn't present it, but I was trying to listen to it on the plane yesterday and catch as much info as I can. The big question mark, secondly, it's a front wheel drive based architecture because it's SPA. So that's a bit of a shame, similar to CMA. It also has a torque vectoring rear axle as an option, which uses clutches, which is fine. We've actually driven an EV with that type of system on our Out of Spec Reviews channel. It was a prototype EV with it, and it was wonderful, really cool tech. But the real big question here is the charging. because it's a 400 volt system architecture, but they claim up to 250 kilowatts, which means well over 500 amps. We're talking close to 600 amps to get it up to 250 kilowatts. And depending on where it falls, it might be even higher. And we've recently started to see Electrify America stations push out 590, 592 amps, which is higher than the CCS standard allows for. So perhaps we're going to see a trend towards higher amperage, which should save on some engineering cost of going with a full 800 volt system architecture for today. Doesn't help with heat loss, but, you know, right. Interesting situation.
And so, along those lines, Kyle, when we're talking about the charging, you know, it's great manufacturers can put out these numbers that, you know, 10 to 80% in 30 minutes, but there has to be infrastructure that can deliver it, you know, and it's good to see that perhaps Electrify America is trying to push the limit on that, but they're really the only ones. So, you know, it's great for the sales team to say, oh yeah, you can recharge this in a half an hour, you can get up to 80% on a road trip. But the problem is if very few stations can do that, you know, if you pull into an EVgo station that, for instance, says it's labeled as a 200 kilowatt unit, but you're on a 400 volt architecture, you're only going to pull 80 amps. And I mean, 80 kilowatt. And that's a big difference in time in charging. So that's one thing to note. I mean, I kind of agree with you on a lot of the points you just said, so I don't need to go all over that. I think it looks awesome. I would have loved to have seen this come in at about $10,000 less, you know, in the low 70s and be more of an e-tron competitor. This is priced almost exactly like an iX. Interestingly, it has almost the exact same battery. The iX has 111 kilowatt hour battery pack. This has 111 kilowatt hour battery pack. So, you know, it's really a direct, it's going to be a direct iX competitor as much as anything. And I think it's going to be a good option. It looks great. I'm sure, you know, everything that Polestar's put out has had great driving dynamics. So I wouldn't expect it not to have the same, but it's up there. That's, you know, you're looking at 83 starting number, even though it's pretty well loaded at that figure. It's an expensive vehicle.
It kind of appeals to me because it's really a huge emphasis on sportiness. What's interesting, though, they have a performance pack that increases the power output. I think they just tune the motors up and things like that. But the brakes are actually the same size, which is a bit of a departure from previous Polestar products, where performance pack always got you the bigger brakes. The one thing I do want to touch on is just back to that charging conversation. Maybe we should have a section on it in a future episode because yeah, I don't know what it actually means when we start going over 500 amps, what it means for what kind of work needs to be done to open up the standard. But I do know EVgo goes to 540 amps. EA we've seen at 592 now. It just seems pretty crazy. So maybe Polestar's got it. And I haven't tested in Europe, but I know some of those charging equipment can output more than what the limitation allows. So Tom, do you think we're going to see this whole network open up to support this car across the world?
So I hope so. And, you know, we're going to, in an upcoming show, I've already spoken with EVgo. We're going to have Jonathan Livy back on the podcast coming up soon at some point, maybe next month. I have to get the dates nailed down to talk about what they're doing over there at EVgo. And that's one of the questions that I'd love to ask him. I know you and I were both invited to the testival this year. I'm wearing last year's shirt. And neither one of us could go, but that would have been a great opportunity for us to talk to everybody about this exact topic. Unfortunately, the two of us couldn't make it this year.
What segment does this car fit into? Because you've called it an SUV, but it's not that much higher than the Volvo, what was it called? V70, the estate car.
Yeah, the lifted wagon thing.
Yeah, like that. That is my. I mean, I adore stuff like that. I used to have an Octavia estate, and it was just the perfect car. And it's not that much higher than an estate car. It's lower than cars like the BMW iX, what you would think is an SUV. I mean, it doesn't really matter what we call this car, but Polestar seem to be kind of going their own way with what they want to do in terms of the styling, the vehicle they want to make. It's obviously got some family values to it, but it's not just a, you know, a slightly bigger
Polestar 2. I really like it. Yeah, expensive, but really like it.
I think it's worth the money. I don't think it's actually priced out of the realm of possibilities. Keep in mind, people are paying $130,000 for Model X's and they're dying to get them. This is significantly less expensive and arguably a better looking car, maybe just as practical for many of the use cases. Of course, a Model X is a bigger vehicle, but I think it's priced right on the money. That's where I would have priced it.
Yeah, I think it's funny. Like, so Tom mentioned its competitor is the BMW iX. And so if you look at the two side to side, I think this looks, you know, definitely better in my and probably a lot of people's views. I mean, I like the iX. It's you know, chunky thing, but you know, a lot of people are turned off by the big grille on the front and all that. But interior wise, like how do you think this is going to stand up? Like, so BMW is like a traditional luxury experience, and this is like a Scandinavian kind of luxury experience. Can they be seen as similar values? I mean, the pricing is the same, right?
I think we're starting to see the Scandinavian experience be more valued than the German stuff. You know, just look at the direction BMW has been taking. Everyone's complaining about how it looks. Everyone's complaining about the styling of the car, even though the iX is a wonderful machine. And then you have this here, which similar specs. Also, someone brought up the point, might have a 400 to 800 volt switch for charging to get that 250 kilowatt. Maybe just an idea, something to consider.
Okay.
We've seen GM do it. And here, this is, you know, this is a product that you buy with passion. It looks cool. It's developed by really cool engineers that are out there that are explaining their story. You know, Polestar is very much transparent when it comes to large automakers about their goals, their design strategy. Their CEO drives a modded Polestar 2 that slammed on big Polestar 1 wheels. Like, it's really cool. It's a cool company. I think people assimilate with that. At least I do.
Very much a global company as well, because the powertrains division is here in the UK doing all the technical bits under the skin, clearly designed with all that Scandi influence, owned by a Chinese company. It'll be made in China to begin with, but eventually be made in the US and exported around the world. So a properly global car. And, you know, you can't really pigeonhole this one. You can't really pigeonhole Polestar. I think that's one of the things I love about it as well. It's a big thumbs up from me.
Right.
But one comment I have to make, learning fast said, but it's slow. It goes 0 to 60 in 4.9 seconds. That's the standard version.
Right.
The performance is 4.6. Every car doesn't have to be a 3 second 0 to 60 car. This would have been considered ridiculously fast, you know, 12 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're being spoiled by these EVs that are running, you know, 4 second 0 to 60s. Practically, when people drive these on the roads, you don't need that. You know, I mean, it's fun to step on it and feel that rush and throw you back in the seat. But, you know, this is a family crossover SUV hauling the kids around, you know, in style. You don't need under 4 seconds, 0 to 60. That's
a Ferrari. A Ferrari Testarossa's 5.2. Like, that was my teenage bedroom wall poster. I know I'm a loser. It could have been Baywatch posters, but it was cars. And it was like that car, like the absolute ultimate performance. So like a Ferrari Testarossa, 5.2 seconds. And if an EV comes out of that, people are like, oh my God, it's pedestrian.
I could run faster. You know?
So real quick, can we talk about the range on this thing? So it's like 107 kilowatt hours usable, but the range is like 300 miles. The EPA, they're guessing. So compared to the BMW iX, which is like a similarly sized vehicle with a similar sized battery, BMW iX has 324 miles of range. You think they're just like sandbagging or something here? I don't know. How do they do it in the two?
I don't think it's been certified yet. Isn't that an estimate towards the EPA? They probably want to under-promise, over-deliver. Again, from a styling compromise, Polestar, my guess, will launch with the most expensive versions first, like we've seen them do before. That's what this price is. And then we'll see a front-wheel drive only one later on, and that'll have more range. So, you know, Polestars have never been range kings, but as long as they charge pretty well, that's fine. I think overall, 24 miles between them, the iX and this, I believe, is a third row. The iX is only two rows.
This is only two row.
Oh, this is only two rows then. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Four-seater, so, all right. Well, at the end of the day, I really don't think that's the difference of making it to a charging station or not. And again, right. It's all about how they optimize for the EPA cycle. It doesn't always mean what we're going to see in the real world.
Right. Yeah. I remember the WLTP number for Europe is actually pretty high. I forget what it is offhand, but you know, just looking at it, I was thinking the EPA would be more like closer to 340 or something. So,
well, yeah, I mean, we'll just see what happens when it gets certified. I wouldn't be surprised if you see it over 300 miles EPA when it gets here, but I'm sure they want to see at least a 3 in front of it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Definitely. Especially with the price tag and everything. But I just want to also point out, we haven't talked about it, is that you can see it, this picture that we're looking at now, it has a spoiler built into the front end there, just like the new electric Dodge Charger kind of thing. I just like it. I just like that, yeah, that styling cue.
Very aero where it passes through. Yeah, it looks cool. And yeah. And with a 111 kilowatt hour battery pack, that's such a big boy that I can't help but think the range is going to be slightly higher than they've said, or that in the time it takes them to get this car on the market, they'll make some efficiency improvements in there. Look, the Polestars and Volvos, the XC40 Recharge, which does all the same bits, also pretty thirsty. So it's not as if they've got a reputation like, you know, Hyundai and Kia for, you know, especially with their previous generation cars being, you know, really efficient. So it's not something that they have absolutely nailed from the very beginning. And I wonder why that is. But yeah, we've seen that in all of the 70 mile an hour test reviews of those cars. They're not the longest distance. But I don't think you sell this car on that. I don't think the buyers of this car, I think when you've made your mind up to spend 80 grand, and yeah, there'll be other versions that are cheaper than this, but when you've made your mind up and that's the car you want, and you're not buying, you know, a Tesla or a iX or whatever, then it's got enough range, but it probably is a compromise a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a little disappointed in the range. And actually, even though 4.6 seconds is plenty fast, I kind of expect it to be at least a 4-second car, but you know.
Really, like you said, an SUV that this is meant to be for ultimate luxury. I think it's got all the range, all the acceleration doesn't tell the whole story of performance. I believe the lead chassis engineer's name is Joachim. He's awesome. If you haven't checked out some of his videos with Misha on his YouTube channel, going around the Nürburgring talking about Polestar's strategy for performance, basically taking existing Volvo products and pushing them well beyond their limits to make the car really handle well, then check those videos out. I think dynamically this is going to be a really neat place in the market, because most luxury electric SUVs, EQS SUV, EQE SUV that's launching very soon, what else do we have? E-tron, iX, Model X. None of these are performance-based. They might have performance versions with M60, with e-tron S, with EQS 580. But, and EQE should have an AMG version, I imagine. But this is built from the ground up to be a bit more agile, a bit more fun, a bit more youthful than all of those. And I think that's the, you know, everyone's like, you don't need a sporty SUV. Well, okay. But I live here in the mountains, for example. If I had to get around, right, in something like this, I'm shredding up canyon roads in whether it's an EQS or an e-tron, no matter what, just to get home. So this would be so much more fun to get through those corners.
Yeah. Mm. So about a year from now, I guess we get the first drives and we get to actually see what it feels like on the road. Yeah. All right.
Hopefully less than a year from now.
But but Polestar looks confident in what they're doing, and that's what is really interesting to me. And I know they've got a big parent company behind them, and they've, you know, they don't need to worry about that. But in many people's eyes, they are a startup. We had a question earlier: who services this? Volvo dealerships? And it's like, in many people's eyes, this is a new name, something that they've, you know, not had before. And all of these things that they've done on this car, the way it looks, the engineering, like I said, the family values. With the Polestar 2, and kind of a bit towards the 1 as well. But I think as a company that has confidence and an assuredness as well, and they know their market. Like, you know, we've all got opinions on the shape and the size and the styling, you know, and do we need a sporty SUV? I've got to say, I think they know their market. And I think the answer is probably yes. For the people with this money to spend that have probably got some boring chores to do with their car, but also when the kids aren't in the back, you know, there's not, you know, your mountain bikes on the roof bars, they want to have some fun. And I think that market there's a bit of money floating around in that market, and Polestar know it, and I think they're pretty much on the money with this.
Talking about Polestar, have you seen an uptick in Polestar 2s at the charging stations recently? I tell you, every time I go now to an Electrify America station to do charge recordings, there's at least one Polestar there. They must be selling well here in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, because they're all over the place.
And I think we may have actually been ahead of that curve, because for about the last year, they've been on every corner. I mean, I have three neighbors that have Polestar 2s there. Wow. And I asked them, like, why'd you go for that over Volvo XC40 or a C40? Because we have a dealer right down the street. Polestar, you got to drive an hour to get to. And for them, this is not a consideration at all. It wouldn't be for me either. They just wanted the Polestar because it was cool and different. Everyone's like, well, I bought it because no one else had one and it looked cool. Now people have them. And people know what they are. So are they going to keep buying them? I don't know. I do know Hertz is buying them. They're going hardcore into rental cars. Sadly, in my eyes, Polestar 1s, the really cool sporty sedan, are actually part of the Hertz rental fleet now. I believe they have a selection of them that you can choose from. That hurts my heart a little bit.
Hertz.
But very cool that you can go and Polestar 2 it up and rent it out, and they're great handling cars, and you can even rent them with a performance pack if you get lucky. They have a few.
One of the big, maybe I missed this in the news, maybe we reported on it, one of the rental car companies just bought a ton of Niros. Did we report on that, or did anybody ever hear that? Because I was at an Electrify America station last week and there were two Niros charging up, and it was a guy that works for, I don't know if it was Hertz or I don't know which agency it was, but he said, oh yeah, the company just bought hundreds of these. And, we're all learning how to charge them and everything, so we could tell the customers, how to do it. So there's a bunch of Niros that have been put in the fleet, at least here. I know for sure.
I don't think I've heard that one.
How is the Polestar holding up in the used market? You can pick one up for £47,000. We're almost at price parity with the euro and the dollar. That's not the end of the world, actually. That is admittedly 63 kilowatt hour battery, but still a couple of thousand miles, single motor version. Okay, and actually the prices might be holding up okay.
Yeah, they're really good. And honestly, I think it might make sense to get a new one versus a used one. What I like about Polestar's model is it's a separate entity from Volvo, which means we can't actually service them at Volvo dealers here illegally. But pretty much any Polestar sales location also has a Volvo dealer. But you pay the price that it says on the website. I haven't heard any complaints about negotiations, haggling, over MSRP. You put in your order and Polestar's managed to do a really good job of controlling that demand and supply, sort of balance, so that cars aren't going for over sticker. I think it's priced really well. The used Polestar 2s are quite expensive. I don't even think we get the small battery in the US. We only get the bigger one, but yeah, we do get a front wheel drive version.
That's pretty common, isn't it? For the US market, just to sort of skip the small. I think, did you do that with the Kona and the Niro? You didn't get the 39 kilowatt hour version of that.
Didn't even know they made one.
And they've just added. In fact, it's so popular that they've added the Kia Soul EV, which some say only have looks that a mother could love. But I think it's quirky and funky.
I like it.
The Soul, which has always come with the big 64 kilowatt hour pack. And it's been a little bit like the unloved version. They've just added the 39 kilowatt hour pack to that, at least here in Europe, because we don't need the big distances as much. And so there's now two versions of the Soul, the Kona and the Niro EV, to give it its new name, not e-Niro, with both battery sizes. So yeah, it's interesting that it totally skips the US market. On the Polestar website, they're making a big deal of the three today.
Yeah.
Starting at 80,000 pounds. There you go. Price parity.
Awesome. Pounds. Right. Right.
Yeah. That's
the same as US dollars. So
it's almost the same now.
Yeah.
It's close.
It's
right.
Almost the same, which I'm not too worried about, even though our chancellor, who's been in the job about 2 months, got sacked today because it was a terrible budget that he gave and he tanked the pound. But my kind podcast supporters on Patreon is how I fund my show. I get paid in dollars. So selfishly, I'm making more money every time our government are incompetent. because I get paid in dollars. Anyway, sorry to derail the show.
No problem. But I think we're done with this.
Martin, what's really quick? What's the range? What's the WLTP range on the 39 kilowatt? That's a big difference in pack sizes. 40 kilowatt hour. That's gross, right? I'm figuring they get like maybe 35 usable. That's like.
Yeah, that's like maybe 169
or than one, an i3 like, battery.
175 miles, maybe. Yeah. Maybe 179. 179 rings a bell. EPA would be a lot less. 30
or something like that. Yeah. I mean, I use 39 kilowatt hour driving down my driveway in my Lightning.
Yes, you do.
And that's downhill. Coming home, I use 50.
All right. So taking a page from the Tesla playbook, General Motors is going into the energy business with a new subsidiary called, appropriately, GM Energy. This new unit will combine the existing Ultium Charge 360 with Ultium Home and Ultium Commercial businesses. So GM Energy solutions are going to range from like bidirectional charging, vehicle to home, V2H, vehicle to grid, V2G, so applications, stationary storage, solar products, software applications, cloud management tools, microgrid solutions, hydrogen fuel cells, and more, they say. So for vehicle owners, the focus is going to probably be on sharing power with your house or V2H. And that begins in 2023, so next year, for a subset of customers within PG&E's service area. So that's Pacific Gas and Electric or something out in California. And so just a subset of customers there will be able to do this next year, but it'll expand to everywhere, I would imagine. So as part of this, GM is partnering with SunPower, that's a solar and energy services provider, to develop and offer a home energy system consisting of integrated EV and battery solutions, solar panels, and home energy storage. The home energy system will be available alongside the retail launch of the 2024 Chevrolet Silverado EV, which is expected in production next fall. So Tom, you're becoming familiar with all these sorts of systems, seeing as you're installing the Ford Intelligent Backup Power System at your place, which already has the solar array. So what do you think of GM's plans here? Too far from its core business, or is this the right time to kind of stretch and get other seek other revenue sources?
So, yeah, it is far from their core business, but in my opinion, this is going to be almost a necessity for the OEMs to get involved in this moving forward. And, you know, the EV is going to be the centerpiece of the home energy, say, ecosystem. And, you know, Ford's working on similar programs like this. They've already started with their Ford Pro, with their commercial line of energy management and software that integrates all these different things into, so fleet managers can really have control over the energy that gets used and paired with solar. Ford partnered with Sunrun to do this. Now GM is partnering SunPower. So yeah, I think that you're either, if you're an OEM, if you're say, Dodge, Chrysler now, you're either partnering with a company that can do this, that has solar, that has home energy storage, that, you know, has a network of installers to do this, or you're simply going to outsource it and let somebody else make money on it. And that's not good for long-term growth. I think it's important for these companies to partner with established brands that know what they're doing with solar and interconnections with the grid and energy management, and partnering with them, because that's the future of this industry. You know, I think we're at the point now where that's clear. It's not, well, maybe we're going to be going down this road. This is the future of personal transportation. It's bidirectional energy flow, on-site energy storage, microgrids, renewable energy. And if you're an OEM and you're going to just outsource that, let somebody else do it, you know, you're going to be losing an enormous profit center in 10 or 15 years.
Right. I think OEMs are learning that, you know, batteries are such a key technology, and they're going to continue to be a key technology for a long time. And there's a lot of value for them to go into energy storage and energy management and like all the microgrid stuff.
It's going to happen.
It's just like the opportunity. So it's either
you do it or let somebody else do it.
Right. And since like this is like the battery is like the core of your vehicle, it's really the core of vehicles. like the core technology is like battery, because right, and it's going to continue to improve in over the next decades. It's like the improvement path is going to be at least 30-40 years, I think. But I don't know.
The only way that I can describe it is when I got a home battery earlier this year in the garage, I understood it all from an intellectual point of view, as in I knew the benefits it would bring. And we've got 16 panels, so about 5.7 kWp of peak solar on three angles here on the roof. So it's not even like a perfect system, south-facing, etc. Let me see if I can bring this up. So my electricity bill is, I pay 5p per kilowatt hour, 5p a unit overnight. And daytime electricity prices, you know, energy crisis in Europe, it's about, you know, some people paying 50p per unit during the day, which is crazy if you have an EV, but I'm on an overnight tariff when the grid isn't being used. This is me, if I can show this to our YouTube viewers. So like this is me this week. So what we're looking at is what I've spent this week. You know, the big number is the pounds and pence. So I'm spending about a pound a day on electricity. But if you look at, say, Wednesday, I use 20 kilowatt hours. That's the top one, 20.82 kilowatt hours. So I probably would have charged the car overnight. But with the battery, because the days are getting a bit shorter now here, is that the home battery charges up as well. So my average of 20 kilowatt hours, my average, that the other number at the top there, is 6.46 kilowatt hour. So I'm off the grid during the day, and I've got a 10 kilowatt hour SolarEdge battery. So it's not even like the biggest battery in the world. I've not got a big Tesla Powerwall, but 10 kilowatt hours for us as a family of three does me absolutely fine. If you look at some other big days that I've had down here towards the bottom, last Wednesday, 5th of October, used 45, 46 kilowatt hours, spent £2.88. But of course, that would have been maybe 150 miles I drove that day. So good luck doing that with gasoline at that price. And on an average of 5.8p per kilowatt hour. So like, I knew all this stuff anyway. But, and don't get me wrong, I know how lucky I am to be able to afford the outlay of £8,000 for a battery. I get it. The people that need it the most, not necessarily, I'm very lucky that I could pay that. But what I'm paying per kilowatt hour, the overnight rate, I'm charging that battery up, I'm charging the EV, and I'm not even discharging my EV to the house. That's just having a home battery. I understood all this before we got it and the panels and stuff. But then when you live with it, and I'm spending almost nothing on my travel and my home energy, you know, and if it, you know, I know your electricity prices are very different in the US, but we're having a real energy crisis over here, 40, 50, 60 pence a kilowatt hour, you know, and you're genuinely thinking, can I make myself a hot dinner? Some people are, you know, if you're
right,
you know, making ends meet, you're thinking, well, that's one less load of washing I'll do or something, or maybe we'll just have a cold meal tonight. And that's firstly a very serious issue, but also like for GM to get into this business, it's, to bring that back to the topic, it's very smart, because everyone should have a home battery. And if we can't use our cars, you should have a battery. But hopefully we'll use our cars for a bit of that as well. The batteries will be big enough, and we can say in some way that it's clever, feel free to use 10% of, or 20% of my battery, because I'm not doing any long journeys tomorrow. And you can buy and sell from the grid. Now, if I wanted to start getting into energy arbitrage and stuff, I could dump my battery back into the grid and sell that energy between 4 and 7 p.m. when it's really expensive and spiking. And I could buy it back overnight. I don't get into all that, because I just, you know what, it's completely hands-off. So right, the best way I can describe it is I knew it, but then when I got it, I'm like, oh, I wish everyone could afford a home battery. Because it just, only using electricity overnight, effectively, because I'm off-grid during the day,
right,
it makes such a big difference.
And what's the payback time you think on that?
It was 11 years pre-energy crisis. It's now 3.5. Last time I did the numbers.
Jeez.
And again, you need the money. There needs to be more creative ways to finance this in terms of adding it to home loans or whatever. Now, look, we're very fortunate that we could buy the battery. And like I say, the people who often need it the most, the ones that can't get it. But true. That's a whole different podcast. But that payback, and that's an asset. So I could, you know, if we needed to, sell it. And I'd probably get pretty much back what we bought it for, because batteries are in short supply over the next 3 years. But either way, yeah, if you know, Russia keeps turning off gas, and if, you know, our government this week did a U-turn on putting solar panels up, which is just bonkers, but anyway,
bonkers.
it's just so frustrating. Yeah. That you know, energy prices are going to continue to be high, And having a battery or being able to use your car, it just changes everything.
Right. Hey, Kyle, do you have anything to say about GM Energy?
Yeah, I think overall, maybe not specifically about GM Energy, but I think automakers are going to have to, and they're learning this quite quickly, shift from a car maker, which is they produce a car and then it's out of their hands, into a full ecosystem provider. The big question I have is automakers, when they sell you an ecosystem, if they're smart, they're going to try and lock you into your to that ecosystem. It's going to become the Apple world, the Android world. It'll be the Honda world, the GMC or the GM world. It'll be the Tesla world we've already seen. The big question is how many individual ecosystems can be supported at once until it just becomes one holistic thing. We've seen it with charging. Automakers wanted to stay out of charging. They wanted nothing to do with it. Then they realized, and they're realizing now quite quickly, oh crap, we might need to take this into our own hands and do some things or make some investments and help out. We've seen it with GM and the Ultium Ready EV Go situation. So automakers have to shift their place in our lives to stay relevant throughout all touch points of vehicle ownership. And everyone's taking a different path, and it'll be 5 years until we have full clarity as to what the correct solution is.
Right on. Hey, so the Renault Twizy is this is one of your favorite cars, I know, Kyle.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to hearing your reaction here. So the Renault Twizy is gone, but it's not forgotten because it now has a successor that is visually quite Twizy-like, but this one is fully enclosed thanks to like side windows on the doors. The innovation at Renault doesn't quit. So offered only through subscription or lease, the two-seater quadricycle can reach speeds of 50 miles an hour, or 80 kilometers an hour, in the Duo 80 version. There's also a Duo 45 version that people as young as 14 can drive without a license in Europe. And that tops out at 28 miles an hour or 45 kilometers an hour. It's got a single motor on the rear axle, like it should, and a claimed range of 87 miles, 147 kilometers. It also has some padding on the seats this time around. The best part, and we'll have to see if Kyle agrees with me, is the doors. So it sports a set of upward opening doors like an exotic car of this pedigree should have. So Kyle, do you like this evolution of your beloved Twizy, or is having like refuge from the elements heresy?
No, I love it. I think it's great. We need more exciting, cool cars like this. Look, no secret. I love weird, small mobility products. It's why I drive an electric smart car a lot of the times, because that's one of the weirder cars we can get in the US. Totally fascinated by this. Still trying to buy an original Twizy over here. Of course, there's import laws, but then it's like, can you pull the quadricycle game? So still very much a desirable product for me. Worst case, maybe we get it at our European location. I think we should order one as soon as possible because I got to have one. They're so cool. Wow, this thing looks awesome. And you could get the last Twizy fully enclosed. And just like the last Twizy, I think you should be able to remove these doors quite easily if you wanted to.
Well, that'd be sweet because, driving doorless is a great experience too. Did the original Twizy go 50 miles an hour?
I drove one. I made a video with one in Oslo last year.
Right.
And I think it did 70 miles an hour because it was tuned. So you can chip tune them. Okay. And that thing freaking ripped, and I was such a menace to society in it. I was so happy. And it's really, I mean, you can make anything go as fast as you want. Just slap a P100D motor in the back of it and send it.
You need the battery to back that up, though.
Yeah, but you really only need like 40 horsepower to make this thing into a real menace to society. It's just cool. I do think the front lighting, if we're on a styling point, isn't as pleasant as the previous generation. I know this is just a concept, but similar to the Rivian, Amazon vans, or other personality or personable vehicles we're seeing, this doesn't seem to have the like eye-shaped headlights. Right. And I think it really could have benefited like the last Twizy from circular headlights to give it a sense of like a dog, if you will.
Right. They sell these in Britain, in the UK, Martin?
They sell Twizzies, but they don't sell this yet.
Okay.
It's great. There's someone not far from me actually that's got about six Twizzies, and he puts them on eBay occasionally, and then he slims down his collection. Then he buys some more and stuff. And I have thought in the past that if he ever gets rid of a decent one, it would be very funny to have a Twizzy sitting outside. My wife would never drive. I'd be the only one that drive. My 4-year-old would love it as well. So yeah, sit behind me and we go on some adventures.
So in 10 years, could your now 4-year-old drive this without a license in the UK? No, or is that a mainland Europe thing?
That's a French mainland Europe. You know, it's 15.
I think it's just France.
Yeah, oh, France. Okay. You can drive them when you're 15, a quadricycle. But, you know, it's so cool that you can just like walk into this, you know, it's not quite Gullwing doors, but it's not a million miles away from a Pagani-Wara.
Right. No, it's almost the same. I mean, they're basically
the same car.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, they're basically the same. You just walk into it. So
basically, squint your eyes a little bit and, you know,
basically the same car.
Yeah.
At least at this point, the Twizy is definitely the superior product, though, because look at that cargo shell on the back.
Yeah, that's the bento version. That's so that's like a commercial, you know, little cargo version. So instead of having two seats, because the regular one has two seats, like, and they're fore and aft, like the regular, like the original Twizy, but instead of that, this one has the bento box on the back.
I like it. Tom, yeah. would you modify your F-150 with ramps that pull out so you can have your little Twizy pod fly in on the back of your truck?
If you could figure out how to import these, I will definitely buy one, or maybe split it with you and we'll take turns half a year each. Because this
would need like 10 of them.
I would definitely use this as like a daily run around town here vehicle. I'm all in on this. Not so much on the AMI that you love. That's not my flavor. This is. I would definitely take one of these.
I kind of like this over the AMI too. I mean, I like the way the AMI looks, but I think this would be a better driving experience. Plus, I think it goes faster, which is 50 miles an hour. That's perfect. Like I could, that would fulfill all like 90% of my driving needs, I think. Yeah.
Makes sense.
All right. So let's move along then. So for 2023, the Lexus UX 300e is getting a facelift and a significantly bigger battery. So I always forget this car exists since it's not sold on this side of the Atlantic. But yeah, Toyota does have an EV on the market. So previously, it was said to get like 180 miles on a charge from a 54.4 kilowatt hour battery, 45 kilowatt hours usable. Now it gets a 72.8 kilowatt hour battery and 280 miles of range. That's 450 kilometers, a huge 40% improvement. Of course, the Lexus UX 300e is also saddled with CHAdeMO fast charge port. So we don't have the charging info yet, but probably not a good idea to get your hopes up too high, because the original had a top charge power rating of 35 kilowatts. I don't know, Martin, we know you're not necessarily the biggest fan of Toyota and Lexus, but will this car have much of an impact in Europe?
Really hard to say, because they, over here at least, are still choosing to spend a ton of money on the whole self-charging / plugging in is an onerous chore that will ruin your life style advert. So it's really, I mean, look, it's really hard, isn't it? So I just think we're also media savvy now. There's something about the social media revolution. You know, I just think we're all wise to company BS. And maybe, I don't know whether it's cultural, I've never been to Japan, whether they feel that it's no problem. Like, we'll run adverts saying plug-in cars are terrible and rubbish and self-charging hybrids are the answer. You know, they go really hardcore on that, and then they try and sell this. So my only problem is, well, which one is it? Like, I don't mind which one it is. That's a lie. I do. I want, you know, I believe in full electric cars. But if I was a consumer, I'd be thinking, I don't mind. Just what is it? But when someone talks out of both sides of their mouth, you know, and obviously, you know, Toyota is still one of the biggest spenders on lobbying for the fossil fuel industry and for the regulations in the US. And it's like, well, you can put an EV on sale, but I know you don't want to sell it. And I know that you don't believe in it. So it's then really hard to know who is spending their hard-earned money on this car. Somebody will, because it's a Lexus. And I'm sure it's an amazing, you know, vehicle when you're driving it.
But, I don't know. I mean, it's got like 150 kilowatt motor, so like 200 horsepower front wheel drive.
That's fine.
Okay.
Probably okay for Lexus.
Fine. So I got to see a bunch of these in Norway. Okay. They were quite popular when I was there last, actually.
Okay.
And yeah, I mean, by quite popular, I mean like, okay, for every 100 ID4s, maybe I saw five of these. But, you know, you see them around.
Right.
And the interesting thing here is now that they have an over 70 kilowatt hour battery pack, this might be bigger news than we're expecting because they may bring it to the US. Because we have the Lexus UX here. And we have a plug-in hybrid NX as well. And so similar chassis, kind of shaped a little bit differently is my understanding. We have the UX 250H, which isn't a bad car. I like the UX, and I'm not really like a modern Toyota guy, but I think it drives pretty nice, looks pretty nice, feels pretty nice. I think this could do well if they can make it charge pretty well. It obviously won't have huge range, but I think we've even seen from BZ4X and Solterra customers, even through the whole wheel falling off thing, we have a lot of viewers who are like, I'm getting my BZ4X and my Solterra. I'm on the list. I'm waiting for it. I'm like, why aren't you buying anything else? And they're like, oh, I'm a Toyota guy. Right. But here we go. Maybe there's just Lexus people that would buy this.
I'm 35. I mean, I don't know what, so we don't know what the charging rate is, power rate is, but I think if it was good, it would be in the press release because this is going on sale next spring, I believe in 2023.
And they're going with Chatamo.
It's Chatamo.
And like, is it confirmed that the facelift will be Chatamo?
Yes.
Okay.
It's like, what are you even doing?
And it's easy to swap a port. Like if they wanted to bring it to the US, they could keep it as Chatamo or they could just put a CCS port on it.
Yeah, it wouldn't sell as Chatamo here. Any numbers, you know, that I could see.
It would, Dom, because I think most people that went into dealerships and bought it would not understand how charging works.
Yeah,
they wouldn't realize until after they got it that they're regulated to that one Electrify America port that half the time doesn't work.
Well, and, that would be bad.
You know, at 50 kilowatts, you know, I think that would be the case. I still run into Leaf owners that. I talked to them at the stations and like new Leaf owners that just got the vehicle. And they're like, why can't I use any of those? How come every time I show up, there's just one plug for me and it's blocked half the times, you know? So, you know, they get it without realizing this whole plug standard issue, you know?
I was charging yesterday next to a guy who had an EQE, I think. It was something that caught my eye of being like, oh, that's brand new. I've not seen one of those before. You know, clearly switched on, smart guy, all that kind of stuff. Like, if you can look at someone and, you know, make a judgment, do you know what I mean? And so at the minute, GridServe, our motorway network, they've got the ABB units with two cables on, but some of them have had the software update to allow dual charging and some haven't. And the ones that have a sign posted, oh, you can use both sides. And again, like you make these assumptions that people know all about EVs and charging. And I was charging the Mighty MG and he came in and, he plugged in and swiped his card and walked off. And I thought, do I run after him? And luckily he did a U-turn and came back and went, I'll just check it's charging. And I'm like, well, it won't be because these units only charge. I've got two cables, but until they get the update, it's one at a time. And he's like, oh, no way. That's rubbish. And I'm like, you seem switched on, intelligent, like as much as you can tell from someone, you know, how they look.
Right. Sure.
And he just wasn't into, and he had an amazing car. He just doesn't spend his life talking about the nonsense that we do. And if you're watching and listening to this, you probably think about stuff like that. He just wanted to drive a car and get on. Yeah. And I was at like 60% and that was enough for me to get home. And I look, let me unplug and you can just wait till you see it go green. And we did. And he plugged in and I left. So, and I was just like a lesson in, oh my goodness, that we're a long way from everybody understanding chargers and plugs and how every, you know, is it an ABB unit or how does that work? And it's just, it's you need constant reminders about this.
Infrastructure is our main problem in my eyes.
Yeah, yep.
Agree.
It happened to me this weekend, Martin. I was charging the Rivian at a site where they only had one 350 kilowatt unit, and I'm charging, and I had just walked away for a second because I just reset the screen, so now I have 60 seconds of freedom before I have to go back and press it again. And a guy pulls up in a Lucid Air next to me, and he grabs the other cable and plugs in. And I'm like, you know, that's not going to work, right? You know, and he had no idea. And he was like so bent on using the 350 kilowatt station because it's faster. And meanwhile, he was at 60% state of charge. So I was like, just so you know, it will make no difference at this high percent state of charge. Didn't understand, didn't want me to explain it to him. You know, was kind of like he knew better. And I was like, okay, but you know, you can use any one of those eight stations open over there. They're all open, you know, and he like wanted to wait for me to finish. I'm like, I'm going to be here like 45 minutes, you know, and it doesn't matter for you, you know, like you could just go plug over there. But he was, he didn't understand. So this is another, an ad for Martin. So Martin, talking about Toyota,
yeah,
you know, they're the number one retail brand for electrified vehicles.
Oh my goodness.
And they're letting you know that because of gas prices, dear gas prices. Toyota is the number one retail van for electrified vehicles. So, you know, add that one to the list.
Add it to the, I'll get you to send me that as a screenshot. I'll put it in the file. Add it to the list.
I actually meant to send it to you before the, before today's show and just forgot.
And this is a really interesting debate that I was having online with someone as well, because I saw, I was up at the M25 ring roads, the London ring roads called the M25. So basically one of the busiest motorways, you know, ring roads in the country. And just off that, it's somewhere called Cobham is six Ionity stations, which I was at. There's some other ones there as well. And that was the flagship hydrogen filling station. At that service park, and I saw one of my friends, actually a guy called Dan, who is the CEO, co-CEO of the Fully Charged channel, just tweeted a picture of where the hydrogen station used to be, and it's been removed. And I didn't even think of to go look for it. But that's the thing with Toyota. They talk so much about hydrogen, and that I don't disagree. I don't disagree in theory, but I think there were six stations in the whole country. Now, I know California's got some more, but no one is putting their hand in their pocket to build that network like Tesla did with the superchargers. If Toyota said we're going to build a hydrogen filling station network globally and it'll be ubiquitous, I'd be double thumbs up on that. But governments won't, because they're all skint now. Toyota won't, and energy companies won't. So they won't, on the off chance that there's more than just the Mirai. So therefore it won't be built, apart from things like trucking and shipping and aviation and heavy stuff. And so, and that's the frustration with Toyota, is they still continue to say, hey, the future's hydrogen. And of course, if you're not into this, if you're reading your mainstream newspaper, website, whatever, and lazy journalists just do, you know, control C, control V and copy the press release. And this is why people talk to me all the time about, you're into cars. You know, the future's hydrogen. And I'm like, is it? Okay, that's good to know.
When the Mirai first came out, I was at the LA Auto Show when they introduced it, I think. And I think it was LA. And they had this plan to build out a hydrogen infrastructure. They actually showed, like in Northeast where I live, where they were going to put, I think, 10 of them within 2 years. And, you know, this was like in, I don't know, when did the Mirai come out? You know, how many years ago was this?
14. I'm not quite
sure. I don't know when it was, but they had locations, even like pins in the map. I'm like, oh, well, that one, I could actually make that one and this one. And I don't think they've done one of them. You know, I know they had one was under permitting, like, but then there was an issue. And then there was another one where like the New York, New Jersey, like Port Authority wouldn't allow them to transport hydrogen across a bridge or through the tunnels here. So they're like, well, we can't put one in New York City because we can't, there's no way for us to refuel it. You know? So, you know, it's, they had at least they announced a plan to build out infrastructure here in this area. I don't know how many years ago, but it just never happened.
December, 2014 is when it came out, the car originally.
Yeah, and that's I was at the introduction, and they had this map with all where all the stations were going to be within 2 years. We're going to have 10 stations in the Northeast corridor and up and down California, and nothing, crickets.
Right. Hey, so let's hit a couple other news topics really quick, and move on to what we've been driving. So, Sony and Honda have announced that they're going to build their first EV in North America. That's so Sony Honda Mobility SHM. That's what they're going to call them each other. I don't know why they don't go with Soho, because it's like right there. But I hope they'll have some sort of actual brand name besides SHM. But anyway, so yeah, they laid out some of their plans. They're going to have pre-orders starting for vehicles in the first half of 2025. So it's still a couple years away. With sales at the end of that year, deliveries early 2026. We still don't know exactly what it will look like. So we've seen these two Sony vehicles already, Sony developed vehicles. So we don't know how much of that technology, how much of that look is going to go into these future vehicles. I would suspect a lot, but we'll see. But it's kind of weird because Honda has its own architecture that it's developing, and also using the GM platform, Ultium platform for, well, the Prologue and an Acura, and as well as a bunch of future products around 26, 27 on the Ultium platform as well. So it's Honda's with a real scattergun approach here. I don't know if anyone wants to say anything about this. Crickets,
more crickets.
Okay.
Let them get a little further along. I love the styling in those vehicles. I think they look cool.
Right.
I saw them up in person. I thought they looked production ready, not like some kind of concept, but let them do a little more work on this before we spend a lot of time talking about it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The one little interesting thing about this is that, so it's going to be built in North America and exported to Japan, which is like a really kind of strange thing because there's not a whole lot of car exports to Japan from anywhere. So this would be like a reversal of the usual traffic flow.
That looks terrible in the back.
Yeah,
it is kind of weird. Right? I've never seen that angle. That's why I've never seen. There's a reason why we've never seen that angle.
Yeah, I've only ever seen the front angle. I've seen the sedan in person, but never the SUV. Wow, that's really not good.
That's a bit bizarre. Yeah, but like I said, this is not a final design. I can't imagine. We'll have to see. Yeah, because it won't necessarily have to have like the Honda styling language at all, right? So I don't know.
This next picture, they've literally hidden it behind the window. Yeah. just put something in the way of the backside of that.
Pretty much every picture they have hides it, except for that one there. They're like, well, we can't completely hide it forever. Let's sneak one picture in.
Well, the other thing about this is that they could have their own independent network. So be like a Polestar, like direct to consumer. So no price haggling and like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, Polestar still runs through dealers. It's just controlled by the automaker.
Right.
And talking about price haggling, Dom, with what Ford has done with Model E, and basically, you know, we're going to learn soon what percentage of their network signed on to this, because the dealers only have till October 31st. They have 2 weeks to decide if they're going to do this or not. You know, if they get a vast majority of the dealers to agree to this, well, they don't really have to in this wave. They can, you know, 3 years down the future. But my big question is, or my point more than a question is, I believe this is going to force GM to do something similar, because when this implements, if it works the way it's supposed to work, and the dealers have set no haggle pricing, that's all on Ford's website. So you can go there and say, oh, this Ford dealership selling it for $62,000. Oh, another one a mile away is selling it for $60,000. Click buy. If that's the case and everything else works the way they're saying, at-home service, drop-off and pick-up delivery, you never have to go to a dealer if you don't want to. You can if you'd like to. They're going to back GM into some kind of a corner to have to do the same thing, because the overall experience is going to be so much better, because you're going to be able to have it any way you want it. If you want to go and see your local Ford guy, go right ahead. If you don't want to, you don't have to. So what do you guys think about GM kind of, you know, and Dodge being pushed into a corner of having to do something similar? Do you think that's going to happen?
So I think what they're doing, they're already okay. There's two problems here with the current car market that might just even themselves out over the next couple of years. I don't know. The first is dealers charging over sticker for a vehicle. The second is people buying vehicles that the dealer may not charge them over for, and then flipping them and making the profit. GM's addressing one of those situations, I think, pretty well, which is the whole vehicle's warranty is void if you sell it after 6 months of owning it. And that's for their specialty models. So Hummer EV is this way. Some of the Corvettes, you know, are this way as well. I don't know exactly which models, but they're nice stuff. You have to keep it 6 months. Really stops that initial big flip. Of course, there's people who are like, I don't care about the warranty, you know, whatever, flip it now. But I think in general, people are really concerned about warranties, and that stops that. From a dealer over sticker standpoint, I think what we're going to see is someone figure out the formula. We haven't seen the Ford implement this yet. I went to a dealership just recently, and they wanted 100% over sticker for an F-150 Lightning. Ooh. And this was a rural, middle of nowhere Oregon dealer. And they're like, yeah, it'll be 140 grand for that Lightning. So we have not seen them implement this. And this was a guy who just got back from the meeting Tom was at in Las Vegas. I met the owner of the dealer, and he's like, oh, well, we're just selling it for 140. We're getting every last drop of juice we can out of this thing. And guess what? Someone will pay for it. And I'm like, well, it sat here for 4 months. I don't think anyone is. But you know, at the end of the day, he can sell it for what he wants. I'm not against the free market. I just, you know, I think it's a bit of a shame that that's what's happened. I don't know what the solution will be, but whoever figures it out, everyone's just going to do it.
Right.
That's why everyone's going to be watching Ford and see how this gets implemented. If it works the way they want it to work, I think it's a model that the other manufacturers will be forced into using.
Yeah. No, I think so too. I think it's got a big forcing effect. Sorry, we've got this people, spammers, trying to get into our...
Yeah, Martin's pretty quick at blocking them, but then they just keep coming back. So they're using different accounts, Martin? Or you block someone, they can't
post
again.
I'm trying to post on my phone and then block on my computer, but they just keep... I can't do it quick enough.
I've blocked it 3 times now. But anyway, so Kyle, let's talk about your Tesla Model S Plaid highway range test. So you have a Tesla Model S Plaid, and you recently did a highway range test. I don't know if we've done the Plaid before. Have we?
And here's another case like the Lucid where Kyle and I have vastly different results,
welcome to different wheels, Tom. It's not the same car.
Yeah, you're 100% right. But that's it. Just the wheels, Kyle.
So Tom, real quick, what size wheels and how much range did you get on yours?
I had the large arachnid wheels on mine, and I rented it on Toro. It was when it first came out. I paid like $1,200 for a day. So it was crazy, but it was worth it to do it at the time. Of course, Inside of Visa did pick up the tab for that, and we did some charging videos and so forth, but I ended up with 300 miles on the nose, and it was a perfect range day. 75 degrees, no wind. I can't blame it on anything else. Now, I will say this, Kyle will typically drive further than I will once the battery gets down to zero. When I think I drove 4 miles after the state of charge read zero, it was a rental car. I wasn't going to have to get it towed and maybe get damaged or whatever. I didn't watch Kyle's video. He may have driven a lot further after it hit zero. So that might be some of the miles, but not 65 miles. So I don't have I'll let Kyle do some commenting on this.
I mean, I think we're just finding out that our range tests, you know, especially up here in Colorado, sometimes lead to wildly better or worse results than yours. No explanation for it, really, other than, you know, conditions really affect it. You know, we're pretty lucky where I have no traffic where I do anything. So when I do a test, it's pretty much just set at the speed. No one's around. It's all live streamed. You can go and watch all the videos of everything, and it just goes. The thing with Teslas are, at least when they're new and when you drive them gently, there is a pre-programmed 3 kilowatt hour buffer on Model 3 and Y. I believe it might be 4 and 4 and a bit on S and X. So I think I went 3 or 4 kilowatt hours. I can't remember. Past 0%. So 0% indicated, we've seen from Bjorn's test, we've seen from everyone, just a big buffer down there. This used to not be the case. Tesla's zero was zero. And we saw a whole bunch of people running out, especially when towing with Model X early days, where you put a huge load on the system, you bottom brick the pack, and it can shut off with 6 or 7, 8% still remaining. And that got really hard. It's also hard to tune for those scenarios. So basically, you can go past zero. And I forget what I did when it hit zero. It's in the video. I forget the number. It doesn't matter. Either way, 365 miles on a charge. Huge result, I thought, for this car. Hugely efficient. Tesla doesn't always show, I believe, all the energy used. We pulled 96 kilowatt hours out of it. Some of my friends who are engineers say they hide some of the heat loss in that calculation. I don't know. Either way, the car went full to dead, and there's the number, and I'm pretty impressed with it. So the reason I did this was because it was the last time I was ever going to have the Model S in this configuration on the aero wheels. I put them back on for this test. It was really good. The car only had 3,800 miles when we left on the test, something like that. But yeah, since we shot this, we now have huge Mountain Pass Performance brakes, front and rear, on the Martian wheels. I'm looking at it over here. Looks beefy. And so now we actually have the braking power to stop this thing, which is a disaster that it didn't come with the brakes from the factory. So many things I have to change on this car to make it usable for me from the factory, but I'm enjoying it.
Did you happen to do a braking test? Just kind of think of it.
Well, the thing is, it wouldn't make too much of a difference, because if you just do one hard brake, the stock brakes can get it into full ABS at limit braking, no problem. Right. So no, didn't do that. I think I actually haven't even driven it with the new brakes yet. Tymon did all the work. I just flew in yesterday. So, right. I'm looking forward to going out, but Alyssa drove it, Tymon drove it, and Colton drove it. And they all said, like, whoa, this thing stops pretty well. So I'm looking forward to giving it a go.
Okay. I mean, it's funny, cause I'm driving your Tesla Model 3. I don't even use the brakes that much, really. I just, you know, kind of coast down to
a stop. Use them from time to time just to clean the discs and things like
that. Oh yeah. No, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I do definitely engage them.
Yeah. Yeah, you can do that. I mean, we need
to slow down sometimes.
Our plan for this car is to, you know, really hopefully show what an electric car is capable of in certain conditions. And, you know, in order to go to the track and set times, we need big sticky tires. We need suspension modifications to come. We needed brakes to come. We need a round steering wheel to come. And these are types of things where we're like, just a few modifications, you might be able to run with some pretty spicy cars at a, I would say, fairly reasonable price. I know it's still crazy, but for the performance numbers, good luck buying anything else that can do what this can do for the money.
Oh yeah, no, that's performance value is, man, it's not really beatable. Yeah. So I guess while we're talking about the efficiency, let's talk about the Lucid. You did a range test too with the Lucid on both 19 inch and 21 inch wheels. Did you want to talk about that a bit? You had a video this week.
We certainly can. So it wasn't a full range test, just an efficiency comparison between 19 and 21. And it's a little bit different, because it's not just evaluating the wheel, it's evaluating the wheel tire combination that comes from Lucid. And so, yeah, I mean, less efficient on the bigger wheels, no surprise. Maybe a bit more less efficient than we were expecting. But again, I don't think it's going to be the difference of someone making a buying decision on the car or not. I still think if you want the biggest range, go for the aeros. If you want the least range, go and the best looks and everything else, performance, all that stuff, go for the big wheels. There's a couple tests left to do with the Lucid. Software 2.0, which we should have mentioned in this podcast. I don't think we did. Software 2.0 is the big change to that car, which they are now touting as rolling out. What's interesting is there's a subset of users who got the software first, and they kept claiming customer cars getting them. But I don't know if they have like a beta software program or what exactly. Maybe they're just lucky, but it was like all the Lucid Twitter fans got this software. And so there's something going on there without question. And whether or not they just wanted the publicity of it rolling out, or they wanted to do some beta testing, that's fine. But just transparency would be great there, because so many people got this software, and then our car, we're waiting here to review it, obviously hasn't gotten it.
So you still have it.
It's right here. It's sitting in my driveway. Yeah.
Sweet.
And so there's a couple things left. I need to do a driver assistance test with it, instrumented-ish on the Hogback. And we need to do a performance driving evaluation, which is the whole reason we sent out, or Lucid sent out, the 21-inch wheels for this car. Because myself and them, you know, they saw that we were testing the car. And I'm like, guys, like, this thing has no real performance cred on the 19s. Like, these tires are pizza cutters. They're 245 front and rear. They're meant for range. That's the compromise. Everything with efficiency or engineering is a compromise. They went hardcore range. With these might be the better suited wheel and tire package, because it's still a 245 up front. I believe 265 in the rear, really still thin. My Model S Plaid on the aeros was a 285 in the rear, just as an example. So a much thinner contact patch here. But with an OE developed tire, maybe it'll handle pretty well. I haven't driven it hard yet on these wheels and tires. So I'm going to do a whole Canyon Blast. Maybe we'll take it out to the testing facility, to the track, and see how it does around there. This is not the performance variant of the car, but really important that we understand how this thing drives in context, I think, of Model S or maybe even a 5 Series or 7 Series or something like that.
So this week, there's also been a big Rivian recall, and you have a video on this. There's this, like, a suspension issue, and so you went to the dealer. Actually, you both have Rivian, so you both dealt with this a little bit, but you have your video up now, Kyle, and I believe Tom might have one coming. He'll tell us about it in a second, but what was your experience handling this recall situation? Because they hit their stock. It came out last Friday, this news, and their stock took another hit. It's already suffering, but...
Thankfully, I don't have to look at stock prices, so I don't really know. I'm right. Not a good company analyst. I have no money, no skin in the game when it comes to...
I just keep an eye on it, you know?
Yeah, when it comes to automaker stock. So, you know, if it's bad, I have no problem saying it's bad. If it's good, I have no problem saying it's good. But we didn't even think this was going to be a big story for us or anything like that. We were just like, had to go run errands down in Denver and happened to be, you know, I knew we were going to go by the Rivian service center. So we're like, ooh, let's not call them. Let's just show up. And this was like right after it announced. So all the owners are going to be blasting there. I expected a full parking lot. And Alyssa and I just hopped in the truck. It's all on video. We just drove there, literally pulled up, and they're like, yeah, hey, how's it going? Scan my VIN. They're like, great. Turn your wheel this way. Ding. Turn your wheel that way, torque wrench, ding. And surprisingly, a lot of twists on my truck. I don't know if mine was backing out, but like, you know, when the difference between tight and really tight, when we're talking, you know, 70 Newton meters plus, is usually just a few degrees when we're starting to get up there. This dude was like 2 or 3 pulls on this. So I don't know if that was specific to mine. I haven't watched them, didn't watch them do any other's trucks. Perhaps mine was on its way backing out. I don't know that to be true. I just know that the fix took less than 3 minutes. I just rolled up, turn, and then we were on our way. And it's all on video. You can watch all of that. And truly a great experience. I think, you know, we happened to get out the truck, and some of our viewers were in line with their trucks as well. We pulled up. No one was in front of us. There was a queue of, I believe, 3 trucks when we left. But again, not that bad because they had multiple techs running out working on them. And it was just a great touch point for Rivian to answer questions about trucks. We saw a new owner who, you know, didn't understand how to put their truck in a high suspension, for example, and they got a little guide as to how to do everything, a little reminder.
Sure.
I couldn't have been more thrilled with the experience. It was easy peasy. And if I wanted to, they could have just come up to the house and done it in the driveway. They really are, in my opinion, executing this recall with ease for the customer. It's really, I think, turned a very negative story into a very positive. The big question is, if you live in the middle of nowhere with your Rivian, I don't know how that all works out. Thankfully, I live only an hour away from the service center. I'm down there all the time anyway. That was easy. I'm sure we'll hear some frictional points, but overall, I think it was really great.
So it was just one corner?
Nope, two fronts.
Oh, both sides. Okay. Yep.
Because the spec changed. It's not even like all were built wrong. I think they're just saying we want to go from 70 to 120 or 102, I forget what it was, Newton meters on that bolt. So the spec changed. So they're just tightening everything up to spec.
Okay. That's a big difference, 70 to 102 Newton meters on a bolt.
Yeah, they're going much tighter. My impression throughout the Rivian was everyone just went just tight enough, but maybe should have just gone a bit more. But I have to say, in terms of squeaks, rattles, you know, put together, my truck makes not a squeak inside. The interior is built really well. A couple little headliner, little things having issue that I want to bring it in for. But overall, just great quality, great truck. Couldn't be more thrilled with it.
Right on. So, Tom, what was your experience with this recall situation?
So, yeah, I got the email last, I want to say Friday. And so I called on Saturday to arrange for it to be fixed. I wanted to make an appointment. Kyle just rolled up, which you were given the option to just show up to Rivian service centers. There, you didn't have to make any appointment. All you do is just show up just like Kyle did. If you're going to go to the service center, no appointments required. You just pull up, and evidently they had all their service centers ready with multiple people to just do this. So I, you know, my closest service center is in Brooklyn, New York. It's 70 miles, but it's a hard 70 miles. It's getting in and out of Brooklyn could be really tough. It could be 2.5 hour drive. So I elected to have them do it at my house. So I said, no, I'm not driving to Brooklyn. You know, you're going to have to come here. So they're like, okay, well, we have an appointment next Wednesday, next Thursday, 4 days later, 5 days later. So I said, I'll take the first one. So they came 2 days ago, and they pulled up in a regular Rivian. I was hoping they'd pull up with the Rivian service vehicle because I wanted to do a video of that. I have a short clip of it when I did the R1S drive, but I wanted to show people all the different tools and stuff that pull out of the truck. And but because this was such an easy fix, they said that they're using those trucks for like real repairs when they have to fix vehicles. So they just had a regular R1T pulled up. And he pulled out with the, you know, torque wrench. And just like Kyle said, you have to raise your suspension up to the highest level and then turn your wheel all the way to the right and goes in 1, 2, 3 cranks, walks to the other side, 1, 2, 3 cranks, done. And they measure what the bolt was when they arrive because they're taking data on, did it back out? Mine backed out a little bit already. As Kyle said, it got a factory set at 70. And mine was at 62. So it already started to back out a little bit. And then they take a picture of the mileage of your truck, as Kyle showed in his video, because they want to see how, you know, where the bolts were at this point, how many miles you're driven. And he was in and out in 2 minutes, as easy, you know, as any service thing can be. He was on his way. So in my opinion, Rivian handled this really well. It's unfortunate, but these things happen. And, you know, Tesla had a very similar, I don't know which Tesla, but I know early on they had the same problem, right? With the same component had to have the bolt tightened because they were falling out. The upper control arm was separating from the vehicle. And it's kind of weird that, like, you would think that would be on Rivian's radar. Like, Tesla had a problem with this. We better make sure it's cranked tightly, and it's 120 newton meter, not 102. So it's a
dramatic, so it was 120. I know it's a huge increase then.
Yeah. Huge increase. Yeah. They're really cranking it down to make sure it's super tight.
Hey, Kyle, I forgot to ask you about your Leaf. So you had a little video this week about your Leaf too. So you picked up the cheapest car in America, electric car in America that's running. Brought it from.
Well, it was actually running or non-running. That was just the cheapest one.
Right. Yep. So, and you brought it back home. And so what's going on with that?
Yeah, I've been daily driving it when I'm here. It's parked at the front of my driveway. It's what I use. I'm about to jump in it after the show and run through the Starbucks drive-through. And it's been truly wonderful to own. We got some cool plans for it. Some maybe potentially a battery upgrade coming. Use the existing one as stationary storage. We'll have to see. I want to play around with all of these things. I was also thinking, and I haven't really pitched this to anyone yet. Maybe you guys will let me know. Would it be kind of interesting to take the existing battery and bring it to Redwood or one of these battery recycling places and seeing how that process works? So I think that would be kind of cool to look at the end of life of battery, because cars have been lasting so long, we just haven't had really much exposure to the recycling aspect.
Right. It'd be great to go inside of Redwood and actually see how they, you know, do all that.
That'd yeah. Awesome. And I have some friends that work there. So it is a possibility. Of course, you know, we'll wait, I think probably till early next year is what it sounds like, but that's something we could potentially do. I don't see why not. But yeah, I mean, there are tons of cool things we can do with it. So we'll see. That is been really a wonderful driver. There's two other cars I'd like to just briefly touch on that I've been driving recently that I've been meaning to talk about. The first is the Mercedes EQE sedan. I had the 350 4MATIC. We did a range test on that. We did a charging test, which hasn't gone up yet. Very low voltage car, 330 volt nominal, something like this.
Really?
But just sits at 170 kilowatt charging, just like an e-tron all the way almost. It's actually not a bad charging vehicle. The problem is you need to use a 350 kilowatt station to get 170, 180, you know, kilowatts out of it, because it needs 500 amps. And so that's where the label on the charger doesn't match the car at all. So when you see these things rolling up to 350s, it's like, yeah, the owners kind of actually need the current output on them. So that was interesting. Amazing driver assistance and digital headlights in the U.S. We still have major regulations about matrix lights, about digital functions.
Right.
But when you put your turn signal on in this car at night, it lights up a big arrow on the road projection. And it like basically alerts everyone you're making a right lane change as well as your turn signals. Really does, cool tech.
But it shines it like ahead of you. So was this on your – which video was this on? Like you showed that because I saw
it. It was
that
on Twitter.
Oh, okay. A little Twitter clip. Yep. And yeah, so it lights up, but can cars around you see that, or is that I can't tell if it's just for you or for it's
I
for
think the cars driver. Around can see it. It's mostly for the driver. I mean, it's just like you got the cool tech in there. What can you do with it? And I think right. we're just seeing the start of it. And I love lighting. It's just a really a unique way to interact with a car. And in the US, we haven't had matrix functionality, although on some German vehicles that I've owned over the years, I always enable it anyway, allegedly. And then I get all the cool functions, mostly with BMW stuff. It's just a switch that you can do that with. Mercedes is a little bit harder to enable, but we have also when you hit a line, like, you know, when it pushes you back in the lane, it lights up the outside lane. It's like, dude, you just hit that, like, stay over here. It's really wonderful. This thing is a really much shorter wheelbase than EQS, but still retains as an option 10 degrees of rear steering. So the turning radius is almost as good as my smart car. And I thought it drove wonderfully. It was not fast, but you can buy a faster one. This was the slow one. And I thought it was adequate for what it was, but I would actually spec up to the more powerful. I think it's a 500 version, the EQE 500. And I just really, really liked the car. Like I ignored it the whole time it was parked in front of the house. Cause I'm like, I had no interest in that. What an ugly blob, really terrible looking car. It's a shame. And I was like, you know, I just don't really want to drive that. But then I had to do a charging test. And so we had 20% in it. So I had to drive it, I don't know, 50, 100 miles, something like that. And we went out to the drive-thru. And then I was like zigging through the drive-thru with no issue at all. Meanwhile, you see all the curbs are just ruined by tires right. and nicks. Really fell in love with the car. I was like, I would buy this over an i4 by the end of it. I'd give up the styling and drive this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 100%.
Huh.
We'll have a whole podcast debate on it because Jordan feels the opposite that I do. But I just loved the integration of hardware and software. I'm a big MBUX fan as well. It does route planning, plug and charge, battery preconditioning, does everything so well. Mercedes gets it. That's what I really enjoy about it. It's one of the first, I think maybe the only German automaker who understands what buyers are looking for from their electric cars.
Right. I think
Porsche does a pretty good job. Porsche is good, but the rest of Volkswagen Group, not so much.
Sorry. Right. Yeah. I think Mercedes doesn't get the credit it deserves for, you know, its path forward in the electrification.
Totally agree. And then I also just want to mention, I picked up the EQB last night. And so drove that up here, which is the smaller SUV boxy thing. That's battery electric. It's a combustion car adapted. Again, wonderful driving car, you know, not as nice as EQE. You can tell it's not built on the same chassis, right. Different strategies when it comes to drivetrain, cheaper feeling in many ways. But yeah, not bad. We'll have to see how it charges. I don't think quite well. I think that's going to be that car's hold up. I think it'll only 100 kilowatt peak.
Did they even have a press release mentioning that they're going to sell the EQB here in the US?
I don't think they did a big media thing with it, but they're advertising it like crazy. No matter where I go, like I've been in a couple of Buffalo Wild Wings and some other places. I'm seeing EQB, it's like electric meets SUV, or SUV is now electric. It's like the dumbest ad, and they got curtains flowing around it. I don't know. Not for me, but I think the car itself like looks pretty good in my opinion. It's the right size, and it certainly is nicer, I think, than Q4 e-tron and ID4. I'm going to compare it to a Q4 actually, because I think that's that car's main competitor. Weirdly, though, the option packages don't make much sense. I don't think Mercedes packaged it right for America. No adaptive cruise control, and this is a high optioned one. So I just think that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah. What's the sticker?
I don't. It's a lot of money. It's like 62 or something like that for a small ID4 size.
So we're talking Model Y pricing. Cadillac Lyriq pricing.
Yeah, the Lyriq certainly is, I think, way more bang for the buck than this. But some people don't really like the Lyriq. I've heard a lot of people don't like the Lyriq. I've heard a lot of people love the Lyriq. And so it's very mixed on that. Also, there is a different feel when you're driving a GM product versus a Mercedes.
True.
You know, just in terms of where the cost goes in certain places. I think you know, you definitely get something for the money with the Mercedes that is not able to be explained on paper. That's very much intangible. But you know, a GV60, for example, I think is like just buy that over this for the same money. But again, these are quite popular. I've seen EQBs all around. They're shipping a ton to the US, And there is some magic in this car. I just need to figure out what it is and how to share that with our viewers and how to share if it really isn't magical and why you shouldn't buy it. We'll see.
Okay, nice. Hey, Tom, so you put a video this week. We have a story on with it on Inside EVs. The Ford F-150 Lightning fast charges like no other EV. We explain. So explain it to me, man. Like, what, I think actually we have some charts too.
I just want to know who we is. Where's the other Tom?
Right. It's a royal we.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I write for Inside EVs, sometimes I speak in we as like I'm speaking for Inside EVs. You know, it's different than when I post my own stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I admittedly, that's a little bit of a clickbaity title. It's more of my F-150 Lightning deep dive charging video, which I've been promising the F-150 Lightning community for a while. I wanted to have it for a couple of months and do like a, you know, 15 or 20 DC fast charging sessions and record all of them so I can then show, you know, how long it takes to get from a certain starting period to 80%. As you can see from that, that's the time to charge chart. I have a 15 to 80, a 5 to 80, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50. And you can see how long it takes because, you know, Kyle and I, we love doing our 0 to 100% charge sessions. And it's important because we need to map out the whole charging curve. But in the reality, most people aren't going to start at zero almost never, you know, especially when you're on a road trip. You might plug in at 5%, 10%, 20%. So I wanted to take my time and really do a deep dive with the Lightning. And one of the things that was interesting to me with how the Lightning, and this is something that, you know, I didn't reveal. Kyle and I have talked about this before on the podcast. The interesting thing about the Lightning is no matter when you plug in, you get this 6 to 8 minute burst of, you know, the max charging power where it pumps like 20 kilowatt hour into the pack in like, you know, six to eight minutes. And then it drops down and holds a charging rate, but basically the same, about the same charging rate all the way up to 80%. So while the Lightning doesn't have a very high DC fast charging rate, you know, it's capped at 155, but people have seen up to 180 during this max charging boost. The fact that it can just hold like 115 to 118 kilowatt all the way to 80% makes up for some of the sins of it not being able to charge at, say, 200 kilowatt. So the whole thing about it not charging the same as other vehicles is with other electric vehicles, you get the maximum charging rate only at a very low state of charge with most other electric vehicles. I'll say, you know, you have vehicles like the e-tron that just kind of you plug it in and bang, it goes all the way out, but that's very rare. Almost all other electric vehicles, you get this 3 or 4 minute minutes like where you get maximum charging rate. My Model 3 could pull 250 kilowatt, but it only did it for a couple of minutes and then began a gradual ramp down. But the Lightning, no matter when you plug it in, you get about 20 kilowatt hours pumped into the pack really quickly. And that's great if there's the charging curve. You see it, all the different starting points. It just constantly pulls maximum amperage. And as you could see, it even increases. You get more power deeper into the pack. That's because it's calling for the same amount of amperages, but the pack voltage is increasing. So it gradually increases as it goes up. And no matter when you plug in, you get that short burst where you can put a lot of power into the pack. And that's great if you're on a road trip. Let's say you only need to go about 50 more miles to make it to your destination. This burst here will give you that. And you can just basically plug in for 10 minutes, no matter where you are in the pack. You know, I'll say no matter where you are under 70%, and you get in 10 minutes, you're going to add about 50 miles of range. Now, one thing I will say that some people pointed out was that Tom, the Mach-E does this similar. And you even mentioned it in your charging recording, which I did. And it does something similar, not the same. The difference that I've found when I charge the Mach-E, and I haven't done one recently, so maybe the new software has changed it a little bit. It does jump up and do like a maximum charge rate, but it does it for about 2 minutes. And you're only adding about 4 or 5 kilowatt hour before it regains its natural charging curve. So yeah, you do get a little bit of a boost but nothing like the Lightning, where you're adding 20 kilowatt hour of power before it starts to ramp down. And I thought that was unique. And as you could see there, no matter where you plug it in, it kind of repeats basically the same charging curve.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I like the way you have that graph, though. It's very visually, you can understand how it's going.
A lot of work went into that video.
I want to mention this. No one realizes the time commitment you had to make to put this together for us nerds. And this is what comes down to a buying decision, though. It's what we've been saying, but here it is proven out. So here we have the raw data of all of this. And that is so cool. Thank you, Tom.
And I appreciate you saying that, Kyle. Thanks. And I'm so jealous of Kyle because he puts out these great videos, these charging videos, without spending days and days editing and putting charts together like I do. He could nail it with just like talking and going on and on, holding his phone saying, see what we're doing here. See the charging curve? That's hit max power. Now look, we have a thermal event. I can't do that. And I'm so jealous of Kyle that he can do it. I have to shoot hours and hours of video, take it home, edit like this, you know, make charts, make graphs, spend 3 weeks on it. So, I mean, we're both, and the good thing about it is we're both doing the same thing, but we take such different approaches. You could watch Kyle's F-150 charging video and then mine, and you're going to learn something different in each one. So, you know, you know, just because you watched my video on something doesn't mean not to watch Kyle's, because we both talk to different points. And I think that's important.
Yeah. But I mean, no question, this is just much, much more data than I would provide. But I have to actually say this is a really bad charging EV, because randomly Mary Barra just followed me on Twitter. So I have, I'm now GM loyalist at this point. So, you know, screw Ford.
It's not, and you know, Kyle and I have discussed this, in my opinion, and I've lived with it for a while now, it's not a fantastic charging electric vehicle. That there's no secret in that. But the fact that it does this, if you watch the videos, like, you know, charging to 80% is really relative. Now hold that up, Martin. You can see here the 30 to 8, the 50 to 80% took 20 minutes. 40 to 80%, 26, 30, the 20 to 80, 30, that's a real typical stop when you're on a road trip, 20 to 80, a half an hour, you know, and totally that's agree. That's not bad. It's not fantastic, but it's really, to me, it's absolutely passable. I'm not going to crap on Ford for this, because the charging curve makes up for the fact that it doesn't have a very high, you know, max charging rate. My Rivian, on the other hand, has a much higher top charging rate. However, it doesn't charge better than the Lightning. And I'm going to put out a video in a few weeks to prove that.
Well, I actually just wanted to bring up a point on the Rivian versus Lightning situation, which is, on paper, the Rivian has a higher peak rate of 220 kilowatts on the nose, which I think is one higher than most have seen.
I saw like 210 the most.
Right. So I've seen 220. The problem is you get one, maybe two good charges out of the Rivian. In warm weather, it's hard to even get one good charge out of the Rivian before you have overheat issues, before there's gradient heating issues in the battery pack. My understanding and my theory, this is just a theory, is that Rivian has not properly cooled the battery pack in the R1T for heavy duty use. Unlike Ford, who's done an amazing job, especially when you get the max tow pack with the dual compressor, that seems to have really focused on getting the cooling to every bit of the pack. Because even in my time with Lightning, and we had it during the hottest week I can think of here in Colorado, and we were towing with it and ripping on it, could not get the battery to overheat. It was pretty impressive. So I think Ford nailed it from a cooling perspective. And I would much rather have repeatable, great cooling than one good charging session, and then I'm down to 70 kilowatts in the Rivian.
Right.
You know what we really need to do, Kyle? We need to get a Lightning without max towing and a Lightning with max towing, and rip them multiple charging sessions back to back to document the difference. Because I was charging next to a Lightning that didn't have max towing package recently, and I was really paying attention to what it was doing. His vehicle was performing exactly the same as mine, but it wasn't super hot out and it wasn't multiple charging. So I'm going to make this guess that the normal person wouldn't notice the difference under most situations. But if it's 100 degrees in Arizona, 110 degrees, that's when you're going to see it. Or if you're on a long trip towing and you're stressing the pack, you stop to charge. 2 hours later, you stop to charge again. That's when you're going to see the difference. This would require a lot of work, but I'd love if we could somehow really do a comprehensive video on what the difference is, you know, but we would need to get a couple trucks and then do a lot of charge recordings.
Well, it sounds like a good adventure we could mix in there as well. Go make some pizza with a trailer. That's what we should do, Tom. We should get two trailers, one that's like a hangout trailer, one that's a giant cooktop, and we'll just go one with max tow, one without, charger to charger, and we have pizza stops with our viewers across the country.
I can get a portable pizza oven and put it in the back. Propane pizza oven. No problem.
I hope someone from Ford is watching this, because how cool would that be? That would be pizza across the country with state of charge.
That would be a lot of fun.
Could you imagine that? Yeah.
I think amazing. Ford would like that.
Let me just pitch in ideas here. Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, they'd probably rather if we got a electric oven though. So we use pro power onboard.
Ooh, yep. There you go.
I don't have that. I have a propane portable oven, but I'm sure we could find. Yeah. See, Bill B put up, use my Uni. Unis are awesome pizza ovens. If anybody wants to really make great pizza at home, they're expensive, but they make fantastic pizzas. And that's from somebody who owned a pizzeria for 30 years. If you really want good homemade pizza, the Unis are really good.
We should start a state of charge pizza.
Yeah, that's it right there. They make great pizzas.
That's not electric though, is it? That's
propane. That's gas. You can get them with flex fuel, with coal and wood and stuff, but it's too much work. Just get the propane.
Yeah. Well, if we can find an electric one, I think Ford are on board. We'll use Pro Power and we'll bring, you know, electric powered pizza.
Yeah. That would be a lot of fun.
City at a time.
Yeah. Let's do it. I'll come over for that.
Maki Vlog mentioned hot wings or shrimp, and Ford will be interested.
We could definitely do the hot wings. I could make a tray of hot wings and put them in the oven too.
State of crust.
There we go. Yeah.
Reserve the channel.
Right. Someone register that.
Yeah. Right on. All right. Well, I kind of wish we had talked about your Ford F-150 Lightning charging thing earlier, because I didn't realize this was the culmination of all that work you've been doing. I can't tell you
how many hours I put into that. I recorded over 20 DC fast charge sessions. Oof. Made the charts, you know, did the numbers. It was a lot of work, but you know, it was worth it for me because, right. You know, I have a big F-150 Lightning community that follows me now because I have it. Okay. And sweet. This is pretty, it's a real comprehensive video. And a lot of people have messaged me saying, thank you very much for doing that. This really is a lot of help.
Yeah. I'm going to throw that up on the forum actually after this is over, and hopefully whatever gets more eyes on it, because yeah, it's good to know. And I got to watch it myself actually to make sure, because I'm sure there's lots of little tips and little nuggets of information that Tom hasn't mentioned here that's in that video. All right. So with that, I think that brings us to the end of our show. If you have any questions or comments, you can leave them on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, please give us a thumbs up if you're watching this on YouTube. Don't forget, you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Follow Tom Malogny at Tomalog. That's with two M's. Martin Lee is at EV News Daily. Kyle Connor is at It's Kyle Connor. And I'm at Dominic_Y. Click subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications. And we'll see you all again next week. Ciao.